So welcome everyone, welcome to a continuation of the theme of birthing the heart. And tonight, one aspect of the heart that I would like to speak about this evening is the intuitive heart, the sense of intuition. We all think we have it. We all think we enjoy our intuitive side. Some feel like it's well developed and others do not. We all look kind of with some admiration for people who seem to have it and when we seem devoid of it. And so I'd like to make it a very common and approachable experience for all of us and not one that's esoteric in any way. So we're going to approach it from the common person's point of view, not from the intuitives. And I think that what we'll all see is that it's very reachable. It's in touch. We all are very available, that intuition is very available to all of us. But before I do that, I want to speak with a little more emphasis on the nature of the reality that we live within, which prohibits the intuitive from arising. And because we stay very noisy, deliberately. Noise helps us define and characterize and compare and contrast, evaluate, size up, and that internal chatter establishes sort of our topography of life. It shows us where we're going and why we're going and what's meaningful about our going. And it's very consuming. And so Dharma practice is really seeing, not dismissing the value of our thinking, but seeing its limitation and being able to get a sense of how the limitation is often exceeds its value, and that often we give verbalization to projections and to ideas that really do not bear any truth to the reality that we're attempting to see. And so as we see that with greater and greater attention, and we see that much of our mind's rambling is just idle chit-chat, really having no basis in reality except the reality of noise. The reality of noise allows us to think as if we have the upper hand in a situation or to have it all detailed out, but it's really just idle prattle. And so as we begin to see that, and we have to see it, we can't just condemn it without seeing it. We have to see it. And then we will start releasing our need for it. So that's one way that we get quieter. We don't get quieter through our journey of samadhi and focused attention and concentration. We don't get quiet at the expense of the noise. We get quiet because we see the relativity of the noise. We see its truth. That's how we get quiet. But the other side of that is that we begin to heal ourselves to our history. So because much of our noise has to do with our history, has to do with our lack of forgiveness, and we've had a talk in this series on forgiveness. And so much of our conversation inwardly has to do with our pain inwardly. It has to do with the ways that we hold ourselves in relationship to other people, how we evaluate and judge ourselves, and this constant inward tension that we have with everything we do is because the history of our lives has been brought forward in that moment and we have not healed ourselves to the arising of it. And that prevalence of our history, as we begin to take it on, look at it directly, come to terms with the emotions that are arising within that history, and bring forth some forgiveness and perspective to our life, that quiets down as well. And as we are willing to see the driving pain that has established our reactive patterns in our life, we begin to quiet down. And so the quieting is met on every front. It's met from our past, it's met on our projections and what we seem to be doing in the present that establishes the reality that we know is here and now. It has to do with the future, because the future is so uncertain that just a little bit of awareness shows us the nonsense of spending much time imagining what our life is going to be. So we slow down, we back off from our need to speak about ourselves, to ourselves, with ourselves, from ourselves. You know, it's interesting. I go to a Y gym, and one person told me that 80% of the people come in order to connect with one another, to talk. And only a small percentage comes to actually work out. Well, I'm in that small percentage. I don't really care about spending a lot of time talking. But, you know, there's a kind of expectation that you're going to join the community of other people when you do join the gym. And so I do what's socially needed in the situation. But I'm not one, I just don't want to talk a lot. And I find that my wife tells me I don't talk enough, but I'm just not given to holding life in that way. And I think it's just having seen the limitation of noise. It doesn't mean I don't like connecting or anything else. It just, I less like being quiet, because I think there's a truer connection that comes from quiet than comes from the noise. In any case, it's a personal example of how this practice begins to unfold in our consciousness, for each one of us, really. And so as we begin to quiet down, the distinction that we have set life to be, the way we hold it, the way we have outlined it, defined it, that begins to become quieter. And so the edges of life aren't so distinguishable. It doesn't mean that everything becomes blurred or homogenized at all. It's just that we're not as interested in distinguishing something from something else, which we were when we were accentuating our knowledge, when we were reinforcing and encouraging our knowledge. Distinctions were important because that was our knowledge base, but it's the other side of that issue that it's just not worth knowing what every single flower or bird is to me. I'm not judging people who do, but there's a kind of way that life lives on its own that I don't have to reinforce by my naming it. And so as that happens, with just being quiet, really, it's not trying not to do it or feeling judgmental about doing it, it's just not seeing the need to do it, we get quiet, still, right? That stillness takes us to a very different level. See, the boundaries that we have set ourselves up for on this dimension of life, in this paradigm, are all set in accordance to reestablish and reaffirm the sense of me in relationship to other things. And as that is quieted, those boundaries begin to release their tension and allow us to cross over them. So the me isn't so well substantiated, and then it becomes more about the we, the community, the interconnection that becomes apparent from the lack of emphasizing the I. And as that happens, it's interesting because the rules of the game change. Not only the rules of the game change, but the laws that were associated with the boundaries, living within the certain boundaries, also change. So you can see just by speaking about it that no longer do all the vector arrows come into me. They're not all pointing in this direction any longer when I'm not reinforcing myself in every sentence I speak, every I, me, or mine approach to life. So with that, the heart begins to radiate outward. It begins to be more inclusive than exclusive. And so when that occurs, there's a sense of interconnectedness. And the new laws come in to bear, come into use with that assertion of a new boundary called we, as opposed to the I. This is extraordinarily important because also the physical limitations that we had imposed on ourselves also cease. Now, this is an aside, but it's my opinion that much of the psychic abilities that people, adept meditation practitioners sometimes arise, where they start hearing other people's thoughts or intuitively sensing what other people are about to do, really comes from that sense of having released their own boundary, their own delineation, their own separation. And so the laws that kept us within that boundary also reaffirmed that the brain was only going to be interested in its own thoughts. And so it separated its thoughts from everyone else's. And so, with that intentionality, with all the lines forced in that way, you don't even know that there's other things available to you, other psychic. And now, the people can manipulate that incredibly, but for the most part, when that does happen, you also have the accompanying ethical behavior that keeps that manipulation from occurring. You aren't interested in using what you sense that person is up to against them at all. That isn't always the truth, and people should be aware that there can be an I that still seeds itself into that psychic dimension, but as I was mentioning, mostly the I has to diminish in order for that dimension to occur, to arise. But you get a sense that the quieter we do become, the more there's a sense of intuition, a sense of a knowing that isn't located in knowledge, isn't in what the intellect already has substantiated or knows about. Now let's clear up what intuition is. Some of us think it's the subtle feelings we might have about something, as if the emotions are somehow more genuine than our thoughts, or more true than our thoughts, and that's not the case. A case in point, actually, was Ellen and I were house hunting some 20 years ago or more in Seattle here, and one of the homes we went into was in a nice area of town. It was a nice home. But we got into the door, and both of us said, "We've got to get out of here." And we turned right around and left. And it almost felt there was just something in the house that wasn't very inviting. And but again, that's not intuition. That was a feeling, energetic feeling of something there in the house. But we like the when we start picking up subtle feelings, we like to claim that to be intuition. We like to say, "Well, I was very intuitive about that person. I had a feeling about them, and they lived up to that feeling." But that's not necessarily true, because emotions are conditioned responses in us, like thoughts are conditioned responses. So to say that somehow you're intuitive because you're more attuned to your emotional subtlety isn't what intuition really is. Nor is it a gut reaction. It's like, "I have a gut reaction here about this." And oftentimes you'll find the gut reaction to be a mixture of conditioned aversion to something about the person that has nothing to do with them. It has everything to do with your conditioning. So that's not exactly what it is either. But it's really stillness-based. It's very interesting. I'm going to give a few stories tonight about intuition in terms of hospice care, because it's beautifully shown through hospice patients. And I'll start off by mentioning a nurse, a dear friend, who's kind of a chatty nurse, except when she got around hospice patients. and she was very quiet. She always was very quiet. Every time I would make a visit with her, there was a tone of stillness that she just, and she didn't try to do it. She just, death brought that out of her. And accompanying that stillness, she had an extraordinary ability to know when the person was going to die. I mean, she would say, he's going to be dead by Thursday night, and this would be a Monday or something. And sure enough, on Thursday night, the person would die. And she was right over 90% of the time. It was just extraordinary. Where the rest of us were like, you know, week off or 2 weeks off. It's hard at that level to know exactly when someone's going to die. So I wanted to know how she was doing it, because I wanted that too. So I said, what are you doing? Tell me what you're doing. She says, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm not doing anything. It just comes to me. And she says, but I'll look and see. So then she would be by the bedside, and she would try to see what she was doing to figure out, and she was trying to pick up whatever the intuitive sense of it was. And then her predictions were as faulty as the rest of ours. And she couldn't get herself back to that quiet state, and she got very angry at me for suggesting that she... But the point of it is that it was coming from the quiet. And it was, I mean, I understand it now, I didn't understand it then, that there was just something that was communicated to her. It wasn't a subtle emotion, it wasn't a gut feeling. It was just opening up beyond her own commentary. See? Intuition, when we get quiet, intuition replaces commentary. The person of awareness, you see, I mean, we start out in this journey in mindful territory. Mindful, being aware, being mindful. And by mindfulness, we mean that we kind of chatter with what we see. There's an accompanying chattering that's describing what we're seeing. We're seeing it, so there's some awareness there, but there's a constant chattering about what it is that we're seeing and how we're doing within our seeing, and how well we're doing with our mindfulness as opposed to everybody else, and how forgetful we are, and how I wish we could could remember more often to be mindful, and all this kind of tension associated with it. Okay, so that's how most of us bring our current paradigm into the awakening experience. But as we quiet naturally, there's an abiding awareness that is free of that chatter. And when that awareness that's free of that chatter becomes embodied, it becomes presence. And presence is not my presence. It's just an accompanying, it's like an accompanying aura associated with whatever one is doing. It's not built upon or cultivated or intended. It comes from the quiet itself. And that awareness extends itself outward so that it touches, as I mentioned, it's really infinite in its duration. And it has this sense of connection. And the connection itself has its own access to understanding. I don't know, you know, the words get very difficult because they're not words of our dimension. They're not words of our vocabulary. They're not words of our distinction. But all of us, quite likely, at odd times when we are silent or quiet for no particular reason except that it comes upon us, we'll notice that we'll say or do something that is quite different than what we normally would say or do in that similar situation. A number of times that happens in interviews or just other odd periods of time. In fact, the body itself begins to move in a way that is very unusual for it. It doesn't move from conditioning. It doesn't move because as cause and response or cause and effect. It starts moving in a kind of seamless way from the entirety of the awareness that sees. And this intuitive sense of what needs to be done, you get a sense of what needs to be done that comes, and then there is the response of the body to doing that, which seems appropriate to do. So it isn't counter. I know many counter to the situation that's present. Some people like to think that they're acting intuitively, and they're kind of like a bull in a china shop. And I know some people, I know a few people like that, who, you know, have some sense of an intuitive arising of what they need to do, and then they just act, but they don't act in consideration to the comprehension, to the clear comprehension of the situation. It doesn't feel appropriate, the action. But they're intuitively, they think they're intuiting it, and that they're just going to do it because they're going to go with their intuition. But intuition carries a heart. It carries the heart. It carries itself. It has a maturing quality to the surround. It's not against the grain. It's an appropriate response given the surround. And a good way to start, if you don't feel that at ease with your body's movement, you still feel that you're moving much more from your conditioning than from your quiet, is to really look around and see what movement is appropriate. So we're just encouraging or inclining our mind towards a spontaneity by first looking outward to see what's appropriate rather than what I just want to do in the situation or what I feel needs to be done. What does the situation call for? And some of us have parents or grandparents, often grandparents, because they've lived to the age where they sense that appropriateness in situations. And you can feel the smooth quality of their actions within the comprehension of the whole. So for the rest of us, starting with the body is a good place to find that intuition. And I feel like the body, what the body does is it sort of shuts down the noise of our mind so that it gives us a kind of a steady certainty of ground. And that steady certainty of ground acts as almost a lightning rod through which much of our mental movement can be grounded into that certainty of place. And once we have that, there can be, if we use it enough, a quiet knowing. A quiet knowing that is that presence that's beginning to arise, that presence of the certainty of, I don't know how to, it's just, there's just, we're not moving from neediness, inward neediness, just to move, just to be productive or to be useful. There's a groundedness to the movement. And so it's a good place to just incline the mind. And what we'll find is that as we screen off some of the normal ways we do move, in order often just to be busy, just to do something, if you take it seriously, you'll see how much of your movement has no bearing on anything except that you just want to do something. And so as that settles down so that you're not being driven in that way, something else comes up, something else arises. And another hospice story, I was sitting with the daughter of a patient on the couch. I was on the couch, and she was sitting on the opposite end of the couch, and she was blocking her mother's hospital bed, which was on the other side of her. So there was the hospital bed, and then she was facing me, and I was turned towards her, talking to her, so I couldn't really see the patient. And then the phone rang. So she got up and went to the phone, and I then had a clear view of the patient. And as I looked at the patient, I could see that she was actively dying. So my first thought was, oh, I need to get the daughter. The mother looks like she has just moments to live. And the daughter was on the phone, and I turned, and I said, no, I that's not the right thing to do. And I have, to this day, I don't know how I knew that. I knew it wasn't the right thing to do. So as I was just sitting there, I went over to the patient and held her hand, and she died. Daughter was still on the phone. Daughter hangs up the phone, thinking I was going to get in trouble. I sheepishly went to the daughter and said, you know, I was just with your mother when she died, and I just thought it was more appropriate for her to die alone. She says, oh, it was so appropriate. I wouldn't want to have seen my mother die. She wouldn't want me to be there. I'm so glad you didn't come and get me. And so I don't know how or why that arose. It wasn't in my hospice manual, that I can be sure of. But this sense of being quiet, having listened to her as she was telling me her story, quieted me sufficiently so that intuitive sense of what was needed in the next moment was very available to me. And so the action was in line with that. So it's not something that we can practice, but it's something that we can get out of the way of. And I think that's what's most important, is that the body becomes an antenna in some ways, a subtle receiving center for, you might say, illegitimate behavior. And if you wish it to be that way, if you really want to sense the body as that kind of antenna, you can, in speech, it will govern your speech. So it'll govern everything. Because when you do something that's counterindicated to what it is that's occurring in that moment, if it's a slightly off or even absent-minded, you will feel it in the body. It will be felt coarsely. Energetic coarseness. And many times when I'm speaking to somebody and my mind might wander for just a minute or a second, I can feel it in the body because I'm not aligned. There's no alignment there. And so I will come back to the body, release the thought, and then retune myself to that. And so there's this enormous, beautiful sense of the body being this receptive center for the comprehension of the situation. And I want to encourage people to use that. Develop you have to be quiet to get a sense of the receptivity of the body. What's coming in through the body? The body has an intelligence that far outweighs the intellect of the mind. And just another story, there was a really wonderful, spirited nurse. She worked in our inpatient unit in the hospice program. And one patient was dying, and she just knew that this patient needed her to get in bed with her. It was a female patient. She was a female. So she got in there and just hugged her, and the patient died in her arms. And I said, you know, you didn't learn that in nursing school. In fact, I'm sure that they tell you not to do that in nursing school. She says, oh, they definitely tell you not to do that in nursing school. She said it just wasn't right for her to, she'd been with hundreds of people who were dying. She didn't get in bed with every one of them. She got in bed with this one because she knew that's what the situation was called for. And the sense of just allowing herself to move in that direction despite the rules against doing just that. You know, we're not conformists. We're not building our practice, our meditation practice around conformity. We're building it around stillness. When we're sitting, we're not doing. Doing is secondary to the sitting. The sitting is establishing the quiet that the doing is happening within. Okay, it's a good model for how intuition, insight is intuition, creativity is intuition, spontaneity is intuition. It's a good model for how intuition can arise, is the model of sitting. The model of sitting establishes an orientation that's very different than the model of how we go through our day for the most part. But the model of sitting sets down, and the point is that it's not moving. It's not focusing on the doing of life. It's focusing on the receiving of life. It's focusing on creating the space where the activities of life can be seen. That space through which the activities can be seen is awareness, is the awareness. And that awareness has, it's the conduit, it's the connected tissue, you might say, that surrounds and is the essence of all things. I don't know how else to say that, except that that's simply the way it is. Now, what blocks intuition? Well, obviously, noise blocks intuition, but opinions block intuition. Thinking that we know what intuition is blocks intuition. So there's no substitute for just quietude. I hope people are getting a theme from all of these weeks, because the theme of the heart is really the theme of stillness. It's not asking anything from you. It wants you to enslave yourself to it. It doesn't want an action that you think is needed from it, which is often skewed in relationship to what its real need is, what life's real need is. Another way that intuition is blocked is how we define intuition and the way people then journey or look for intuition. They look for it in kind of exotic ways. And therefore, everything that's normal or commonplace can't be intuition, that it has to be more esoteric. It has to be, you know, and then such people, you know, just dismiss anything of normalcy. So, you know, they're looking in a direction that they think is where, you know, the strangeness of life lies. Well, this quiet is as strange as life will ever get. And it's in our lap, right? So if we want to find the alternatives to life, I mean, you get so that it's just a whole self-distinction to form yourself around that particular, I can only, alternative eatings, alternative medicines, alternative approaches. No, it's like, okay, so that's your definition of life. It's no closer to what the real thing is than what you had before. The sense that there is a opening to what's going on, And then there's a deciphering and a wisdom that comes in terms of appropriateness as well. As I mentioned, the action that I had that night, that evening, when I was talking to the woman's daughter, the patient's daughter, not getting the patient at the time that it happened to me felt appropriate. It felt right not to go get the patient. I didn't know where that rightness came from, but it felt completely right for that patient's daughter not to be there. And so I went with that. And so the sense of wisdom also infiltrates, is part of that whole, a part of the whole journey of the intuitive. Now, there are two qualities of the intuitive heart. The first quality of the intuitive heart is the ability to open beyond the sense data. All right, because the sense data is just the details and depictions of events from our senses. And our senses are organized to pick up and define what is happening as out there and me as in here. And the senses then reconfirm that certainty. So it's not, we're looking for a quiet, not the absence of noise, which is just sense data that doesn't contain a certain ingredient called sound. We're looking for a stillness that holds the senses, whether there is sound or not. That's a different level of stillness. That's the stillness of the container, despite what it's contained. So if we just allow ourselves in this moment to sense that, don't look for the writing on the wall. Don't look for it to come through the mind's door. I need to do this. It's not going to be, it's not going to have a verbal message necessarily associated with it. It's going to feel organic. And so this, so we're just encouraging a proximity, a closeness to stillness that is unfabricated, that is not human-made. We're not confusing what's going on with our commentary about what's going on, which is the real difficulty, is that there is a commentary that's going on and we think we know what to do from the commentary. But the commentary is so exclusive of so many parts of the reality that's arising. It's so focused narrowly around what I am thinking about and all the objective opinions and attitudes from that thinking that we can't find the intuition there. It does come from surrendering our past, not being burdened by our past. If in that moment that the daughter had left, I thought, oh, well, I've got to go get her. If I had just listened to the censor in me, the commentary in me, I would have done what was appropriate that the commentary told me to do, which was to go get the daughter and bring her back and have her be with her dying mother. And in probably 9 out of 10 cases or 90 out of 100 cases, I would have done that because it would have been the right thing to do. But in this case, it wasn't. How do you know that? It's not a subtle feeling. So what I'm suggesting to you is from time to time, just in the course of things, when you're outside, when there isn't a lot going on, not a lot of your doing, just say to yourself, add nothing to this experience. Get a sense of the communion that is already there. See if there is an appropriateness of action. Not in your commentary. And if it's not, it's not. But you will find yourself moving from the quiet. And it won't be because you're afraid of the quiet or because of a conditioned response of that inward talk, that inward speak, the flow of thinking. Look for ways to disrupt that flow of thinking sufficiently so that those spaces of quiet can become more and more familiar. To do that, you have to step out of an enormous burden that most of us carry. That burden of needing to be productive, to be useful. The burden of most of our movement. Because presence is embodied awareness. It is not embodied mental turmoil. That's what our bodies usually are embodying. And so the whole thing is wide open. Can go anywhere. Okay. So if we can just sit for a minute or two. See, let the sitting really inform your life. We don't give enough credit to how the sitting informs how to live. There's a deliberate willingness not to physically move. Because in physical movement, the whole thing gears up in terms of goals, production, and all of that. So all of that sort of takes the needle off that record. So your mind can still be busy, which it will be. But it's so clear that it doesn't represent anything. That it's needless. So to follow it or to invest in it has no point. And when there is no point, there's the divesting of energy in what it's saying. And now that energy goes towards that awareness that sees what we are saying, that hears what we are saying. And it's from that quiet that can hear that intuition arises. The intuitive heart. It's not, none of us are devoid of it. None of us are missing anything. in our spiritual journey. It's just how noisy we are in relationship to our life. Often forced by our pain body, grumbling, or irritable, annoyed, complaining. Okay, so if there are any questions or comments, yes, sir.
Last week, the question was asked about the situation where you're in conversation with someone and in the middle of it, they turn away and focus their attention on something else. And I was in the middle of writing what you had to say in response, and I got half the sentence down, but not the part that explained it.
This was last week?
Yeah.
And you think I'll remember that? It just isn't there. Sometimes I use that example to indicate a deep pain that some of us have for not being recognized or being met. And that sense of self-negation or being dismissed can open up a huge opening of pain in us from all of the childhood experiences on up to present day in which we were not noticed, not seen, dismissed, unattended to, et cetera, right? And so we feel that pain immediately with some projection of the current situation in relationship to all the past incidences, which may not have anything at all to do with why the person is not paying attention to us. But the assumption is, and we really validate that assumption, that it does have something to do. And it has something to do with how worthy I am to be paid attention to. And it's that assumption that we need to pay attention to, not the lack of attention that we're getting. Does that make sense? Okay. You took yourself out of the mix.
Incredible.
Yeah.
It's just like,
no, she's.
The yeah. World is conspiring.
Right. So let me just ask that people keep their questions so that I can repeat them back.
Sorry.
That's okay. The question in condensed form was that sometimes she finds, you know, instead of just losing her whole sense of ground with what's going on, she just reframes it to say, "Oh, the universe is working to solve this." It takes your individual role out a little bit, doesn't it? And you can see, can you feel the quieting within that reframing, right? Right. Okay. So, but first we got to get to the quiet. Okay. So when you reframe the issue, I mean, if you're under the stress that you have to solve it or that you get caught up in it all, there's a lot of noise in that, isn't there? But if you reframe the issue, and there are a lot of skillful ways to do that, one of the is to kind of extend the burden of it beyond yourself into consciousness and into the whole of it. And say, you know, this thing will just, to see the imperfection of, the perfection within the imperfection, you might say. You know, this isn't up to me to solve, or something like that. But when you do that, you can feel the release of the tension associated with how you were defining it. And sometimes you'll drop very quietly within that release of tension. And then that's a conduit for something, for you pick up the phone and do something that you normally would not have done within the tension. And then you can see that it had its rightness, right? Given that situation. But if you try to replicate that, you know, now you're conditioned to try to make it work, and it doesn't work because it's not from the quiet. It's from noisy. It's from noise, you know, and you can't do it again. So it has to be spontaneous. It has to be spontaneous. And it, you know when it does, when it arises like that, because it feels appropriate. It just, yeah, I'm going to do this. Spontaneity is not devoid of appropriateness. It feels that. If you're like, oh yeah, right. It may feel different than you normally would do, or maybe a little odd, right? But it doesn't hurt anybody. It's not cross-grained. So practice that a little bit. And again, when you practice it, I don't mean to practice the repetition of the response. Practice what got you to the quiet. Yeah? Right. Good.
I noticed that I'm wrong about a lot of things. I want to get better at being right at it. I found myself during the talk thinking, okay, maybe this is the way. If you open up and really let the complexity of life in, then you'll make better actions and choices. And to some extent, you said that, but I'm wondering, is it compatible with productive and the way that sort of driving it forward into productiveness?
So is intuition compatible with staying involved and being useful and being engaged? Is that... Don't let me put words in your mouth.
So, I guess if it's always spontaneous, then you can access it at any point. If it's productive, then you can learn it. You can kind of keep trying it and doing it and get better at...
Okay, so it's not that. It's not... You can get better at being quiet. You can get better at being quiet. I mean, you can get quiet more often. I guess that's what it means to be better. It's not a competition. If it's a competition, it's just going to be noise. So being quiet needs to draw you in. You have to see, incline your mind to that because you see the need. You see the value of it. You don't do something because you should do it. If you do it because you should do it, you're just engaging it from a kind of tension. I don't really want to do it. I should do it. And that tension keeps it from happening, right? But after, much of this is just in line with the practice as it unfolds over time. So at a certain point, you start relishing quiet. You don't know where that came from. It's like me at the gym. You know, I don't know. I didn't set out to be quiet at the gym. I just really don't want to talk. It's not aversion. It's nicer to be quiet. And your life will start humming from that dimension. Things work better. Things don't work well when you're noisy. They really don't. It's much smoother. It's much easier to unburden yourself of that. And as things start working better, it invites more of the same in. If it's this good now, think if I were even quieter. Again, it's not an achievement motivation, but it draws you in, it draws the heart out because you see its value. And it doesn't stop. You can stay just as proficient as a dentist. You can be on top of your game. You can be game. You can be just as efficient and effective, even more so, than if you had the tension that you bore upon each procedure. If it just felt like a natural movement from going from this to that, rather than the tension of I'm 5 minutes late and I've got to hurry this up so that I can get to that. Right? So it can't be taught as a sequence. I need to get quiet in order to be more useful and then more productive so that I can. It's not like that. It's just because you want the quiet, and then the whole thing starts changing from there. So just see if quiet invites you in, if it's something that you like, if it's something that you enjoy. You like being quiet? You like going outside and just listening? Do you? I mean, I don't know. I mean, the first thing, you know, some people, when we get into the rhythm of production, the first thing you do when you go get in your car is you turn on the radio. Because you have to have something speaking back, because being alone in your speaking isn't sufficient compensation. So if you're looking for noise to feed you, then you're getting noisier, not quieter. Quieter comes from really wanting to know what is true, what is there. Not what I say is there, but what is there, what is actually occurring. Huh? Yes. Would I say that finding the quiet in the stillness is similar to being present in the moment? Yes. Being present in the moment is the first inroad, the first step into quiet, isn't it? So being present in the moment allows us to see what is there, despite the fact that there's a lot of talking going on about what we see. But it's the first step. Because if you look at your life, there aren't a lot... Before we start the practice, there aren't a lot of times when we're actually present to what we are doing. We're just operating like a robot through the day. This stimulus evoked this response, and on and on. So the first reason that we want to step into awareness is to learn and settle with what's going on as opposed to what we think is going on. And when we do that, we're beginning to see, and that seeing is quiet, right? And then we like what we see, and we like the relationship to what it does to us to see. So we want to get quieter. And so we're not, the background noise that constantly comments upon what we see isn't really valid. It's just like a, some announcer at a sports game, right? And so we're not going to, we stop paying as much attention to that. And so it doesn't get fed, and so it quiets down. See, it happens organically. That's what I want you to hear. And then we see more, because what was happening before is we were seeing a little, but we were listening to the commentary, and then a lot of what we were seeing was coming through the commentary. But now that the commentary has died down, we see more. So the sense of presence or availability of quiet is even more. And it just keeps walking in that direction. The meditation walks towards stillness. It's the only way the direction, the only way the meditation can walk. It walks us towards more quietude. So if you find yourself getting noisy in your meditation or judgmental or, you know, that's irritating because it's because your life is based in noise and you don't want to step out of it. It's the way you're inclining your life, and then you can't take meditation along with you because meditation requires a different response in relationship to your life or order for it to generate. Does that make sense? Yeah.
When you sit down to get quiet and you have this to say what Moffat was sort of expressing as well, this expectation that it'll make you more productive, that's when you start bringing in the conditioning.
That's right. You see, what we're doing, I mean, if you, every class we look at some way that we condition noise into ourselves, and I set it up as homework, so you can see, oh, this is not healthy for me. This is, you know, that's what the homework is meant to do. It's to show us needless noise. And so when you see needless noise, you think, oh, I don't need to do that anymore, and then you get quieter. That's the point of everything we've done for how many decades I've been doing this. Okay? So, all right. So expectation is one of those infiltrating things. When you have an expectation of what's going to occur, you're meeting the unknown moment with an idea of how it's going to unfold. And then when it doesn't live up to how you expect it to unfold, there's a disappointment. Or, on the other side, there's a joy because it did unfold in the way you expected. So the happiness and the unhappiness is related to the meeting of what your expectation was, you see. But if you go through life that way, it's like turbulent. So what's it look like? So you want to say, okay, what? I bring expectations to everything. I wanted to hear a good talk. I wanted to, you know, whatever. And boy, am I disappointed. So if it was, if you just meet it, you see, it's like, first of all, there are no expectations. So whatever you get, whatever is gleaned is communal. It's connected. That's where the joy comes, from the connection that was met by showing up without expectations. And I would have never known that because I always bring expectations to a moment and then get disappointed because they didn't live up to it. But in the quiet, there's communion. And the joy of being comes from the communion. And that's from the absence of expectation. But how are we ever going to know that, you see, unless I investigate and look at my expectations, you see. So every homework has a point along those same lines. And now, I'm going to be quiet. Thank you all.